Robert Cohen here. We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute moon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
So many policy problems. A group recently formed to raise money to help reunite the Mexican and Central American immigrant kids forcibly separated by the Trump order. They hoped to raise $15,000 and have so far raised over $20 million. Of course, that's very heartwarming. It says a lot about the American people. We care deeply about the value of families as necessary for kids to grow and thrive. Not surprisingly, the shock at seeing the images of these terrified kids in cages, crying, freaking out, sparked outrage across America. Well, what about our own kids? Are we neglecting them? As our guest on this segment, Professor Kara Drynan writes in her new article on Huffington Post, after claiming for days that he did not have the authority to address the family separation crisis at the border, President Donald Trump appeared to do just that with the stroke of a pen. So they stopped taking children away from their parents. However, nearly 2,500 migrant children still remain separated and incarcerated from this initial round. So the outrage persists across our country, of course. Yet, as Drynan writes, there are vulnerable kids in cages in every state across America whose cases will not be affected by the president's new order. She reveals that hidden behind the massive walls of correction facilities in every state, there are some 50,000 juveniles, oftentimes in adult correctional facilities. The tragedy of the migrant kids is everywhere on the news, but that of the significantly more numerous kids is unseen. They're invisible. And our juvenile justice system means it to stay that way. Just as once we know about the horrors of the injustice at our southern border, we feel compelled to act. So it's important to be made aware of the bigger picture, the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used today. Well, our guest today is Kara Drynan. Professor Drynan is a nationally recognized expert on the Sixth Amendment, right to counsel, juvenile sentencing, and criminal justice reform. She earned a B.A. in economics at Bowdoin College and an M.A. in politics, philosophy, and economics at Oxford University and her J.D. at Stanford Law School. She's past recipient of both the Truman and Marshall Scholarship. And after a brief period in private practice, she joined the law faculty at the Catholic University of America in 2006. Drynan teaches criminal law, criminal procedure, and related seminars. Her research focuses on nationwide criminal justice reform and, most recently, mass incarceration's impact on juveniles in America. Widely published in law reviews, Drynan published her first book in 2017, The War on Kids, How American Juvenile Justice Lost Its Way. Boy, it sure did. Her article, Outraged by Kids in Cages, Look at Our Entire Juvenile Justice System, appears in Huffington Post. Professor Drynan, Kara, thanks so much for being with us and keeping democracy alive.
Thank you for having me, Bert.
Well, you say that the United States today is an international outlier in the severity of its juvenile justice practices. What specifically makes it so?
Well, it's important, I think, to recognize at the outset that the U.S. is an international outlier in all respects when it comes to our criminal justice practices. So we begin from the standpoint of recognizing we have more than 2 million adults and children behind bars in this country. We lead the world in our rate of incarceration. And even though we only have 5% of the world's population in the United States, we have 25% of the world's prisoners. So that's our starting point. We are extremely punitive across the board. And then in that context, I think it's easier to understand how those draconian practices have affected juveniles.
Yeah.
Every state has transfer laws that allow juveniles to be charged as if they were adults. Mm. Until 2005, we were the only developed nation to execute individuals for juvenile crimes. And today, we are the only developed nation that employs juvenile life without parole. So there's no way around it. I say in my book, the land of the free has become the world's largest jailer. And that's true for kids, too.
And, you know, I think most Americans really just aren't aware of that. I think one of the working parts of the design of our justice system is to keep it invisible. People don't think about all these people out of circulation. They just, you know, it's kept from our view and, you know, out of sight, out of mind, I suppose. Well, we all remain upset about the injustice, the blatant injustice of 2,500 migrant kids being taken away and held in detention. How many non-migrant kids are being caged, do you think?
Yeah, so I'm happy to answer that question. I just want to piggyback on what you just said a moment ago. I completely agree with the out of sight, out of mind point. And I think one of the reasons we're all outraged by what's happening at the border is that we're seeing it. And so I wish that we were seeing similarly the images of our own kids in cages in every state across the country. So how many kids are in cages in America? So the good news is fewer than there used to be, right? In the late 1990s, we had over 100,000 youth in some kind of residential placement. So we've seen massive decline on that. Not so good news, on any given day today in America, there are more than 50,000 kids in some form of secure residential facility. And these are very distinctly correctional places. Uh-huh. They're not camps or the sort of sunny names that they may have do not indicate the realities, right? 90% of them are locked facilities, and most of them use mechanical restraints, things like handcuffs, leg cuffs, and restraining chairs. So we have a lot of kids, a lot of youth in this country who are behind bars every day.
Oh, I can't imagine what that does to kids for the rest of their lives. And there's so much to talk about. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Live. We're talking with Professor Kara Drynan about the kids that are being held in cages, 50,000 or so across the country that are out of sight, and what that means and how much neglect is really going on, and how I don't think it's really providing a correctional service, really. You know, the idea of housing juveniles in adult facilities, I think it's fairly new, is it not? I mean, how long has that been going on?
It is new. It's so juveniles land in adult facilities because we have laws on the books that permit them to be charged as if they were adults, right? These are so-called transfer laws. And those laws are relatively recent, as you indicated. They're really a product of the late 20th century tough-on-crime trend that created mass incarceration itself, right? And so for most of the 20th century, a child who was accused of a crime was dealt with in juvenile court. Now, a prosecutor could argue for transfer to adult court, but doing that, transferring a youth out of juvenile court into adult court, was difficult and it was rare. In the 1980s, however, states, again, as I said, part of that tough-on-crime movement, states introduced laws that made that transfer process easy and common. You know, on that rationale of adult crime, adult time.
Uh-huh.
So because those youth are charged as adults, they then also, fairly recently, can end up in an adult correctional facility.
Mm. You know, and as someone who is, at least in theory, grown up and an adult, you know, I think about being a teenager. You know, sometimes teenagers do dumb things. And when you combine being a teenager with extreme poverty and, you know, just a sense of hopelessness all around you. Oh, my goodness. Well, what kind of offenses land kids in adult jails?
So let me first begin by saying that it's a small percentage of juveniles in the system who are in adult jails. Now, that doesn't make it any less awful for those individuals who are there, but it's about 1 in 10 among detained youth who are in an adult facility. And again, how do they get there? It links to that question of how states charge kids as adults. So in most states, there is an upper age limit to being charged in juvenile court. Most states, it's 17. Mm-hmm. So the day you're 18, you're in adult court. But because of those transfer laws I mentioned earlier, youth below that age of majority can be charged as adults, usually for more serious crimes, crimes against the person, robbery, aggravated assault, homicide, sexual assault. But it can also be a drug crime or a property crime. And if that youth is charged as an adult, they may very well be sitting in an adult jail awaiting trial.
And so what happens to kids in these adult facilities? I hate to even think about it, quite frankly.
Yeah, you can imagine it's a nightmare. Prison facilities, as I've learned in my research and in talking to any number of prisoners, they're tremendously difficult spaces to navigate. Right? You have a web of correctional rules that govern everything from where you need to be at any given time and how close you can walk to fences and how neatly you keep your cell. So there's this web of correctional rules. And then there's this secondary set of rules enforced by prisoners, right, that involve hierarchy and status and maybe gang affiliation. So youth in these adult facilities are navigating these two sets of rules. And then on top of it, because of their physical and psychological immaturity, they're incredibly vulnerable to physical and sexual assault. So, for example, when the federal government passed a law called PREA, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, one of the findings on which it passed that law was that that young inmates were 5 times more likely to be sexually assaulted in adult facilities than in juvenile facilities. So 5 times more likely to be raped in an adult facility, often within 48 hours of being incarcerated. So we know that that young inmates are just incredibly vulnerable in the adult correctional setting. And that's in part why you see, if you look at, for example, the record of disciplinary infractions for a prisoner, it's very typical for a young prisoner to have a high number of disciplinary infractions and then, to have very few as they get older. And that's, I think, quite simply because prison survival requires aggression or victimization, right? Mm. One or the other. Mm. And so these young inmates are really facing a double bind.
Oh, my goodness. That's a heck of a choice. Now, I'm sure one of the main factors, if not the only factor for this mass incarceration that we have across the country is that, I guess it was the 90s when politicians were terrified of being labeled soft on crime. Mm-hmm. Now, what you're a professor of criminal justice know a lot about this stuff. What we're talking about here, if we're concerned about the fate of these kids, are we being soft on crime? How do you answer that charge if somebody says, oh, you're soft on crime, if you don't want to punish them?
As you can imagine, I hear that a lot.
So
I say any number of things. The first is most kids who are in the system are not there because they have been accused of a serious crime, right? So we have to keep our eye on the fact that most youth in the system are there because of low-level offenses and that the brain science tells us most youth will simply age out of delinquent tendencies, right? So it's not being soft on crime to seek as a goal keeping kids out of prison, right? That's not being soft on crime, that's being smart on crime.
Uh-huh.
And the second piece is, oftentimes people point to really horrific crimes. And my answer to that is not to minimize the experience of those who are victims of crimes. We have to take those cases seriously. But they do represent a very small percentage. And so we can't craft juvenile justice policy around these extreme outlier cases, right? We can't deal with nearly half the states, for example, have laws that make it a crime to disrupt school. We can't criminalize typical adolescent behavior because there are extreme outlier cases of violence. We have to be smart and not simply tough.
As you point out, black youth are five times as likely as white youth to be detained, even as the overall detention rates have fallen, end of quote. Is that because black youth have more innate proclivity to commit crimes, or is there another explanation?
Well, as you can imagine, it's not the former, right? It is not because black youth are more inclined to commit crimes.
Right.
And let me also just mention, Bert, that in six states, the disparity between black detention and white detention among youth populations is even starker. In six states, black youth are 10 times as likely to be detained as white youth. And it is not because they commit crime at higher rates. Unfortunately, it's because, as with our adult criminal justice system, race and class matter at every juncture in the system. So, for example, black youth live in neighborhoods that tend to be policed more often than white youth. Black youth tend to be stopped and frisked more often than white youth. Many studies indicate that people, including law enforcement, simply based on physical appearance, think of black youth as older than they actually are. So these are all things that have to do really with a legacy of injustice in this country rather than actual crime trends.
Just amazing. I mean, you know, we know this stuff, but most of the time we just don't want to think about it.
And absolutely.
The concept of equal justice for all is an important basic concept that's essential to who we are and the laws of our country. It assumes equal justice, assumes that in theory we all start out on the same equal plane and that those who commit crimes, you know, need to get punished for that. Is it actually true that we all start out on the same equal plane and that, you know, that's necessary to the concept of equal justice?
Yeah, it's just not true, right? And so, unfortunately, one of the things that we did in the late 20th century with the introduction of mandatory minimums and what are called determinate sentencing schemes, right, instances where the law says we only look at the crime, we look at the offense, not the offender and their circumstances. This is one-size-fits-all notion, right? It's deeply problematic because, as you said, we don't begin at the same plane. And so any number of variables, all of which I talk about in my book, can have a profound effect on whether a child has contact with the criminal justice system. So poverty, for example, excellent piece in the New York Times recently by Nicholas Kristof talking about just the devastating levels of poverty in this country. Poverty, we know, shunts kids into the criminal justice system who would not be there if they could buy their way out, right? So, whether that is making bail, paying the fee for an ankle bracelet, or going to a high-priced wilderness camp as opposed to facing juvenile detention. So poverty is one variable. We've talked about race. That's, of course, a profound variable that affects the likelihood of contact with the system. We know, for example, there are other community variables that make it more likely for a child to have contact with the system. Exposure to violence, for example, whether it's domestic violence or neighborhood violence, it can alter brain development and increase the likelihood of criminal activity. So too can substance abuse, as well as physical and emotional abuse. And many of these variables are things over which a child has no control.
Right. No control at all. I mean, that's one thing about children and why so many people are so deeply upset by the images that we're bombarded with of these kids being yanked from their parents and put into cages. Because kids are basically, they don't have the same capabilities. There's a large degree of innocence there. And you note, Professor Drynan, that by the time a child enters the criminal justice system, he or she has typically endured tremendous stress, abuse, and neglect, typically endured. What is being done to actually address the high disproportionate rates of black kids being caged up and those factors, the circumstances, as you say, that don't give the kids much of an opportunity to do anything else if they want to survive? What's being done?
So sadly, the short answer is not enough, right? And I think that is laid bare in the reality of movements like Black Lives Matter, in the NFL Players Coalition, in protests around gun violence. I mean, you see people waking up to the reality that we aren't doing enough for individuals who are coming into the system, you know, a product of circumstances over which they had no control. So I think we are seeing some groundswell around public support for the idea that kids should have an equal shot at progressing as young adults in a healthy way. There are a couple positive things that I would like to focus on, and I feel like it's a little strange to do this just after Justice Kennedy announced his retirement.
Yeah,
but,
I know.
But I would say the Supreme Court in recent years has, I think, provided some really important moral leadership on curbing the extremity of juvenile sentencing practices. And that has definitely trickled down to the state. So it's just within the last 15 years that we've abolished juvenile death penalty and significantly limited juvenile life without parole for individuals nationwide. So those, I think, are small when you look at the day-to-day reality. But as I said, it's important moral leadership.
Yes.
And we'll just keep our fingers crossed that the court keeps that trend.
And I hope those decisions weren't 5-4 decisions with him as part of the five. I don't know, but maybe because it's not politically, in the limelight, that maybe that trend might actually continue. You know, we need to have that same compassion.
And I think, too, Burp, one of the reasons I'm cautiously optimistic about that trend sustaining itself is that it is supported by brain science. Right,
yes.
Those decisions really relied upon the neuroscience community saying, look, the frontal lobe of our brain is not developed until the mid-20s, right? And that's
right.
The part of the brain that governs judgment and problem solving. And so because of that, kids are impulsive and they're subject to peer pressure and they don't make good risk assessments. So I think with that scientific underpinning, hopefully those decisions are safe.
Well, not only do Black Lives Matter, but science matters too. What a concept.
Yes, indeed.
Now, there's the whole concept of corrections. You write that what happens to locked up juveniles is not good. There's very high recidivism. We spend billions a year to confine youth in detention centers in a system which is called corrections. How well is that goal of corrections being achieved by the current system?
Yeah, again, not well, right? And again, if you look at our system writ large, not just at kids in the system, our recidivism rates indicate that we aren't doing something corrective. When you have 2/3 of released inmates returning to the system within 5 years, that's not a good indicator. And I think that's largely because we're not doing the investment on the front end that we need to do, right? We're not asking what drove delinquency in the first place. Was it a learning disability? Was it a family situation? Was it substance abuse? And then we're not investing in that within the correctional system. So, there have been studies that have shown for every dollar spent on education inside a correctional facility, we can save 4 to 5 future incarceration dollars.
I'll bet.
But for some reason, we've been reticent to embrace that and to implement that.
Well, I think on a massive scale, the idea of investing in the front end when it comes to the environment, education in general, why people in Mexico and Central America come here in the first place, we don't do that. We could, certainly. I mean, our trade policies, so many things. We don't think about it at the front end and investing in the front end. You know, it's a good idea in capitalist theory to, invest first before you have to pay later.
And it's one of our fundamental political process problems, right, when it comes to criminal justice, because typically politicians don't win big political points for saying, let's improve conditions of confinement for prisoners.
Yes.
I promise it will pay off in 15 years.
Yeah.
Right? It's a hard sell politically.
It is.
I will say, though, at least prior to the election of President Trump, One of the things I found most promising about criminal justice reform was that it was being really driven by the right and happening in big ways in typically red states. So I think that tells us something about the fact that this is not a political issue. This is just criminal justice reform is the right way to move on these issues, and it's not a left or a right issue.
And how is that's interesting. How is that initiative starting out? Where's it coming from in those red states? That's a little bit surprising.
So I think a couple of things. I mean, first of all, after the recession, many states that had otherwise had very punitive practices on crime realized they could no longer afford it. And so in many instances, it was just fiscal crisis that brought states to the table to say, how can we be smarter about the spending we do on corrections?
Wow.
So that was one piece. I also think that if you look at the exonerations that have happened and the Innocence Project movement,
yes,
even though many of those cases have been capital cases, I think it has revealed to the American public that our system is broken and can make mistakes. So I think the combination of fiscal constraint and the realization that the system generates errors brought both sides of the aisle to the table. Unfortunately, you know, we are living in an era where, again, back to the facts matter point, we are hearing statements from the Attorney General and from the White House that would suggest we're under some crime wave siege, and that's just not true. So it's very difficult to sustain the momentum of criminal justice reform when the narrative from the commander-in-chief is that we're living through a massive crime epidemic.
Right. And there's actually the immigration, as you know, obviously, has gone down, is not going up. There is no actual immigration problem. It's actually improving. But that, you know, facts are beside the point. You know, we've just largely, for the most part, been warehousing kids and exacerbating their underlying trauma. And you talked about that appropriate sentencing laws are coming about because brain science has told us quite a bit. So are better forms of treatment and corrections, if you will, known and readily available? Can we still protect the public from people who have done unacceptable things and come out with better results? Are there other ways to do it that are known right now that we could implement?
Absolutely. Right. So that same science that I spoke of earlier, that science tells us that because of the elasticity of the juvenile brain, if you will, that kids are less culpable. But the great news is they're also more amenable to rehabilitation. Okay, so that's the good news, that they're sort of plastic in that way. The science also tells us that incarceration has what's called a criminogenic effect on kids. It's a fancy way of saying it makes them better at crime,
right?
And more likely to commit crime. And I think it's pretty easy to understand why, given the realities of prison that we spoke of earlier, right? What the skills a person needs to survive prison are the exact opposite of what they need to be productive members of society. So we can be safe and also employ the science that we have. For example, we can use risk assessment tools that we have available to help us figure out who needs to be in some kind of secure detention facility and who doesn't. We do not need 53,000 kids on any given day to be locked up. And we have the scientific tools to help us sort out who indeed is a risk to public safety and who's not. So we could dramatically reduce the number of kids in detention doing that on the front end. We also know that kids respond better to positive incentives than sanctions. Anyone who's a parent knows that, right? So we can alter our probation terms so that we're incentivizing positive behaviors. And we also know that things like substance abuse treatment, family therapy, parent coaching, addressing learning disabilities, all those things that we can invest positively in for kids will keep them out of prison and on both a short and a long-term basis.
And when I'm sure
the fact is, Bert, anything we can do inside a facility for a kid, we can do better on the outside.
Hmm. Fascinating. Well, if people are interested in this subject, which is a big, big subject, and I think it's going to become bigger in the next few years or so, our guest, Professor Kara Drynan, has a book out that was published in 2017, The War on Kids, How American Juvenile Justice Lost Its Way. Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for your insights and a little degree of hope there. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll be back in just a couple minutes, but this is a song by the Rolling Stones called Rough Justice. Stay with us, please. Maybe we can have a little more effective, cheaper justice than the current system of rough justice that we have now. Well, switching subjects entirely, we're going to be looking at the power of words. Yes, the power of words. Not everyone thinks the matter of what words we use is an important consideration. You know, people think, yeah, just say something here and it doesn't matter how accurate it is. Ever since the start, some 40 or so years ago, of the Republican effort to cut funding and destroy public education, more and more Americans seem to care less and less about getting the words right. And they have achieved their goal, I'll tell you, of cutting funding and what it's resulted in. I found that sometimes people get upset when I take their words literally, which I tend to do. But what else do we have but people's words? Our current president appears to just shoot from the hip and not give much, if any, thought to the words he uses. I guess he's popular because of that. The key word here is appears to just shoot from the hip and not give it much, if any, thought. His base very much likes this image, and as many of them are skeptical of public education, they call them government schools, as if they're indoctrinating people. The level of anti-intellectualism has certainly increased in recent times. I'm sure you, dear listener, have seen it as well. Being well-educated is often seen as being elitist. And we know of the widespread antipathy toward elitism. Anti-elitism very much helped elect Donald Trump. According to our guest, the words he uses are indeed quite intentional. They're not just off the cuff. Avaya Kushner, I hope I pronounced that right. Did I pronounce it right? Okay.
It's actually Avia.
Mm-hmm. Avia Kushner is the Forward's language columnist. The Forward is a great long-running newspaper. It used to be called the Daily Forward, the Jewish Daily Forward. She is the Forward's language columnist and author of The Grammar of God. And she's written about two words in recent headlines, the words that Trump has used, infest and civility. How much does Trump know about the meaning of the words he uses? My guess is, despite his act, he very much understands the words he uses. For example, did he know any history of the phrase America First? When he first used that phrase, it had been written by Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller, you may boo and hiss now, both rather openly fascist and racist, Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller. No doubt they were fully aware of its use by people like Nazi sympathizer Charles Lindbergh, pushing for America to stay out of World War II and let the Nazis have their day. That he was with the America First movement, and I'm sure Trump knew that. Well, at least the writers of that phrase did. And speaking of Nazis, what about Trump's recent use of the word infest to describe hopeful immigrants to the U.S. from south of the border? Our guest, Avia Kushner, writes, the word infest is not only remarkable, but terrifying. You also write that the roots of the particular word infest are telling. Thanks for being with us. Please tell us about the roots of the word and why the word infest is so terrifying.
Hi, Bert. It's wonderful to be here, and I do think that words are very, very important right now. The roots of the word infest come from Latin and French. And the French word infesté has its roots in the Latin word for assail and for the word that means hostile. And by late Middle English, the word infest means to torment and to harass. So there's a definite sense of torment, harassment, hostility in those words. But I think more importantly, it's important to understand that there's a very long history of characterizing people as vermin, as carriers of disease before killing them. And that's what made the hair on my arm
stand up. In the Middle Ages, Jews were blamed for the Black Death. So Jews were cast as the carriers of disease, and that led to massacre. And it's no accident that the Nazis picked up on that. And one of their most famous films, it was a propaganda film, and it portrayed Jews as rats. So it's the same idea, the carriers of disease, they're going to come in and they're going to destroy your area. And I think that that is no accident. I think that characterizing people who want to come into this country as the bearers of disease, as people who are going to take over the space, is not accidental.
Mm. Yeah, and the fact that that film, The Eternal Jew, I don't know the name of it in German, but it had, I've seen it. I'm frankly hoping most listeners have not seen it because it's pretty ugly. It's like really horrible. It certainly drove home the images of the rats scampering around, drove home what was meant by the word infest. And so did the Nazis actually use that word infest?
No, I don't think, well, that's a good question. I don't know if they used the exact word infest.
Right, but they certainly
that was, I mean, if you have footage of rats taking over a space, you know, that is the meaning.
Yeah.
I think you touched on something else that's really important. You know, even though we're talking about words, I think we also are experiencing an assault of images, you know, and that's what we see in Melania's jacket and in some of what we're seeing. And that's also something that's very familiar from totalitarian regimes. The Nazis definitely believed in the power of film. Goebbels was personally involved in that film, The Eternal Jew, and it was extremely popular in Germany and throughout occupied Europe. And I think one of the things that's interesting about it is that, you know, they forced Jews who were imprisoned in the Warsaw Ghetto and the Lodz Ghetto to be filmed. And what they were trying to show was that no matter how you were dressed, beneath it all, you were vermin, you were a rat. Hmm. And I think that that's what we're hearing in the use of the word animals, the use of the word infest, and we see it in the image. I thought it was a horrible tweet from former Governor Mike Huckabee, who's the father of Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and I think it's important to state both a former presidential candidate and a pastor, tweeting out an image that many people understood immediately as racist. So I think we're seeing both an attack in image and in words, and what we're seeing is this attempt to classify some people as A, not like us, and most chillingly, not human. Hmm. And that's something that Nazi propaganda can be, unfortunately, very instructive on.
And certainly that word infest portrays that. I mean, I can't imagine Trump and Pence saying that immigrants from Scandinavia are infesting us, or from, you know, Northern Europe are infesting us. It's clearly racist and trying to make them less than. We're talking with Avia Kushner about the use of words. She writes for The Forward, and the terrifying initiation of the word infest. And I actually am not familiar with what Mike Huckabee tweeted out that you referred to. What was that?
Yeah, it was referring to Nancy Pelosi. It was an image of bare-chested, dark-skinned men, and I think it was clearly intended to enforce the idea that people who are seeking refuge in this country are actually criminals. You know, that's what it looked like to me. And that's also very old, you know, characterizing the other as a criminal element, as somebody who's going to steal all your money, take your homes, take your land. That's very familiar. I don't want to give Mike Huckabee more play than he's already received, but you can certainly look it up and see what it was. And I found it astonishing that anybody who had run for president of the United States would feel comfortable tweeting out that sort of image to make a political point.
And one thing that I have heard way more than I would have thought is people actually saying that these people who want to come here, who are escaping, you know, violence and, you know, gangs and and horrible oppressive governments that parenthetically we helped install, you know, that the fact that they want to come here, that's criminal. they wouldn't be coming here unless they were criminal. So that whole class of people is right. criminal just for wanting to come here, which amazes me. As we know, Trump labeled Central Americans as infesting America. He also characterized immigrants as animals.
Yeah.
He tries to claim it was about that one particular gang, but yeah, right. As you point out, many people just wave that away, claiming he was only referring to gang members. What's your take on that?
You know, I think that's a very interesting question because among Trump supporters, I hear two kinds of statements. You know, one statement is, oh, that's just language. He doesn't mean it. And the other is, I love this guy. He tells it like it is.
Yeah.
You know? So which is it? I think what's interesting about the it's just words thing is that, unfortunately, we've seen, you know, he began the Muslim ban in his campaign.
Yes.
And we now know it's not just language. You know, this is law. So I think that the first argument of, he doesn't mean it has been proven to be untrue.
Yes.
You know, we've seen that this week. And I think that the second one, he just tells it like it is absolutely part of what's firing up his base. You know, I mean, this So that would be my answer to that, that it's it can't be both. You know, it can't mean nothing and something at the same time.
No, this is true. And his base, you know, I was so naive growing up in the 50s and 60s to think that mm-hmm. racism was something just a few mm-hmm. rednecks had in the South of America. You know, it's obviously not the case. And Trump has brought out, yeah, he does tell it like it is for a lot of people who are, frankly, quite racist, you know, and it's pretty ugly. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. We're talking with Avia Kushner about the use of language largely by the president. And what about the taking away of kids from their families? There's an ugly precedent for that, too. Also going back to the 30s and 40s in Germany. Please tell us about that forced division of families.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for anybody familiar with Jewish history, that immediately brings up memories or something that you've read or seen about families divided when they arrived at concentration camps. You know, there were two infamous lines, one for life, one for death, and children, the elderly, the pregnant were immediately gassed, and those considered able-bodied were made into slave labor. But I think it's also important to understand that the idea of separating families is also intertwined with slavery. And that's absolutely something that's a major part of American history. You know, certainly families were divided during slavery. And since Attorney General Jeff Sessions has quoted the Bible, I can invoke it as well. And I can say that, you know, that's one of the key storylines of the Book of Exodus was Pharaoh and his decree on male children, you know, male babies.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the things that sparks the major narrative of the Book of Exodus. That's how baby Moses ends up in the reeds. So it's pretty amazing to hear the Bible misused in that way. But I would say that the history of separating families goes back to Pharaoh.
Interesting. I had forgotten that, but that's exactly right. That's obviously why Moses was put in that basket, because they were separating it.
Yeah.
And I unfortunately have a very clear memory of a Nazi soldier dragging a kid off from his mother. People care about that. Americans don't like that. We really don't. The president, we were talking about Mike Huckabee, his daughter Sarah Huckabee Sanders, as you know, we all know, was asked to leave a restaurant because the owners wanted to make a statement that they do not approve of the Trump agenda. Shortly thereafter, Congresswoman Maxine Waters, who's gotten tremendous publicity from this, urged Americans to continue to speak up when they see Trump officials in their midst, in public, not to let them have peace in the face of what they are doing to America. And now the forces of the rather extreme right, which is bigger than I would have expected, are demanding civility. You know what I'm saying? They are demanding civility. They want us to quietly accept and acquiesce on the forced removal of children from their parents and be nice to those carrying out and ordering the outrages. Be civil toward them. Many seem to think that the word civility means having good manners, being nice. But as a student of words, Avia, what is the actual definition of the word civility?
Yeah, you know, I'm really glad that you brought up the word civility because it's one of the few words in a recent political discourse that actually has a deep meaning. We've seen a lot of meaningless phrases being thrown around like womp, womp. You know, that doesn't mean anything, right? But civility actually comes from the Latin word for citizen. And what it means is the appropriate manner for free citizens to treat one another. And I just want to zero in on that free aspect of it. Okay, I think the free citizens thing is crucial. We're not talking about citizenship of a country, like citizenship of America, but citizens of the world. What the word civility comes from is how free human beings should be treated as opposed to slaves. So what's at stake here is freedom and whether human beings have basic rights. That's the deep meaning of civility. I think colloquially a lot of people are used to another dictionary meaning of civil, which is, you know, civil marriage, so not of the church, you know, something like that, something secular, something lay. But I think most deeply it's about the basic decent treatment that a free person should give to another free person. And that is actually, I think, at the heart of what we're talking about here. Because the people coming to the border, they may not be citizens of the United States, right? But they're human beings. They're citizens of the earth. They're citizens of the world. And how should someone be treated, I think, is a very major situation right now, because I think what we're looking at is a test case for cruelty. It's how much cruelty can Americans stand? And so that's why I actually think the word civility is a good one. It's a good word to think about and a good word to look into and to think about the difference between civility and citizenship. You know, because Donald Trump loves the word citizenship, but he never uses the word civility. And yeah, it's important to understand why.
Yeah.
You know, it's very important to understand that.
And,
you know, it's a piece of paper versus decency.
And certainly, you know, in various protests in the civil rights movement, the gains were not made by people saying, oh, you know, you can discriminate, you can be a racist, I'm not going to, you know, be mean to you, I'm not going to speak up to you, I'm just going to let you do your thing. No,
right.
Protests, you know, are disruptive. They have to be disruptive. And, you know, the demand for people to not do that is demand for the current, you know, racist, mean-spirited, cruel policies to continue without interruption. So talk more about, you know, as you say, Trump used the word citizen over 1,000 times, never used the word civility. What? Tell us more about that. What is the significance of that?
Yeah, I think it's extremely interesting to look at which words this president uses over and over. And there's an online tool. It's FactBase. FactBase is a dot to SE, and you can track it in real time if you so wish. But I would say that one thing that I see is a main theme of Trump's language from his campaign to through the present moment, is defining who we are and, most importantly, who we aren't. So citizens can enter the United States. Non-citizens, such as refugees or university students who are coming here for an education, forget it. So I think that that's something really, really important to understand. I also wanted to quote Time magazine had a very interesting headline this week. It had something along the lines of, one of the major jobs of a president is to tell us who we are. And I would add to that, and I think that this president, through his language, is spending a lot of time trying to tell us who we aren't. And that's something to pay attention to. So this constant use of citizens is talking about all the people who don't get a chance, have no protection, nothing at all, can't come in, can't do anything. But I would say most chillingly, I think it's important for us to think about what does American citizenship actually involve? What protections do we actually have? I think one of the reasons that he likes using citizens so much and couples it with his praise of dictators is that in these dictatorships, citizenship really doesn't mean very much. Just like the word nice, which is a word he uses constantly,
right.
I believe over 2,400 times, it means nothing. And I think one of the things that a lot of Americans are worried about right now is, wait a minute, what is my citizenship actually going to give me? Is it going to give me freedom of religion? Is it going to give me freedom of the press? You know, so I think it's really important to think about that and to worry about, wait a minute, is he trying to redefine citizenship and say, you know what? Citizenship does not give you this, 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 and this. To me, that's the deepest danger that we have.
Wow. The word citizen is very important. I agree. And here, the show is coming from New Hampshire. We had a governor for one term exactly, which has only happened once, I think, who changed the Office of Citizen Services to Consumer Services. And there's
Right.
There's a huge... Citizenship means participation, you know, of being, as you say, decent to one another and participating in the government. It's a huge difference. And they do obviously want to change that. And we talked, you mentioned earlier a little bit, Melania Trump. When she visited that immigration detention camp, she wore that jacket that said on the back in big letters, clearly no mistake that she was wearing that. I think she has a big enough wardrobe to choose.
Yeah.
The jacket said, I really don't care. Do you? Talk about that, please. That just amazes me.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the first things I thought about was back to my high school dress code. You know, I went to high school not very far from actually where Donald Trump and his children were based. And there was a rule that you couldn't come to school with slogans on your shirt. You know, you couldn't do that. So I think that it was very, very noticeable. Number one, that's back to the image thing that we were talking about before. We're definitely experiencing an assault through imagery, and I cannot remember another first lady ever wearing a slogan. That's number one. So I think that it's back to this concept of what is the basic treatment that we can expect. You know, I think a basic, in my high school, basic respect was you come in complying with the dress code, you know, and I think that number one, she's violating the understood dress code. But from a language perspective, I think the message was very clear. Again, very back clear. To that general, to what I see as the chief theme of what's happening right now, who we are and who we aren't, who we care about and who we don't care about, who counts and who doesn't count, who can vote and whose vote we can destroy in whatever means we feel like, you know? It's back to who counts. So I think her message comes down to that civility question. Just says, you know what? You don't count. I don't care. You're not who I care about. And I think it mirrors what the president is doing. He's playing to his base, and it really doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. It doesn't matter. And that's a major concern for us. A major concern. It's and again, it's not just about language. But as we've learned, it has consequences. So I really don't care about you, to my mind, translates immediately to law to prevent you from voting and law to prevent you from doing all sorts of other things which we consider basic rights of citizenship.
Boy, that's some powerful stuff you just said there. And you're right, we're talking about civility because its deep meaning and Latin roots are under attack. And we run the risk of mistaking a test run for fascism as a mere referendum on polite conversation. Wow. If you could explain what you mean in that sentence. That's some powerful stuff.
Sure. I think that the rudeness and the coarseness of the language that we're experiencing is very distracting. You know, but we've never had a president of the United States speak this way. We've never had major political leaders behave. We've just never had it. So I think that it's very, very easy to get, even though I write about language, I think it's extremely easy to just focus on the fact that it's rude. You know, it's just, yeah. And an example, I would say, was today I saw a very interesting tweet comparing the signature at the Yad Vashem, the memorial to the Holocaust in Jerusalem. It was what Donald Trump wrote and what Prince William wrote, you know? Uh-oh. And Donald Trump wrote something like, "Friends, this is amazing!" exclamation mark, you know? And of course, it's unbelievable. You know, this is a monument to genocide, right? And it's not amazing. It's not a great restaurant, oh right? So it's very easy to focus on the fact, wow, did he just use amazing and an exclamation mark to describe a Holocaust memorial, you know? And so, right? You think about that, but then I think what's deeply happening is, wait a minute, how much can you stand? How much can you stand, which is the first step to fascism?
Uh-huh.
How many rights, what are you willing to give up? It's distracting. So I think that what you're really willing to give up is, are you willing to give up your innate distrust of dictatorship? We have a president mm-hmm. who not only says that it's amazing to visit Yad Vashem, exclamation mark, but he's praised Putin, he's praised the leader of North Korea.
Yeah.
We haven't seen this from an American, calling him very talented. So I think that, I think we're in this moment where it's, how much can we stand, you know? How much will we give up? And that's the test run for fascism. So I hope that explains. I don't know if that's clear enough, but I think it's very easy to get distracted by the unbelievable rudeness. But I think the deeper question is, wait a minute, what is being erased while we focus on how insulted we feel, how horrified we feel, and how much we're flinching? Because the real story is rights. That's the real story.
And erasure is so important to myth as mm-hmm. opposed to actual mm-hmm. history. Little bit off subject here, but among Democrats right now, there's disagreement about whether or not to be nice with Trump partisans, to be polite with them. The argument from 2016 was, well, when they go low, we go high. Your thoughts on this strategy?
Yeah, you know, it's a wonderful question. I think that we were all charmed by Michelle Obama's love. We were all charmed by it. When they go low, we go high. And I think that it fits into our myth of what the United States is. You know, we answer to a higher power. We have these ideals. You know, we have, it made sense to us. But more recently, I saw a line from the comedian Kashana playing on Michelle Obama's statement, and she said, "When they go low, we die." And I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. Yeah, I think it's kind of amazing, right? That's what she said, and it was in response to the developments in the Supreme Court this week. I would say that the truth is somewhere in the middle of Michelle Obama and Kashana.
Yeah.
I don't think that the way forward is to go even lower.
No.
I really don't. You know, I just don't want to see...
fight back.
Yeah, I don't want to see us in the gutter. I really do not. But I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think that the candidates of the future are going to have two qualities that relate to language. First of all, they're going to have to be able to function in the face of insult, because insult is where this president is most comfortable. That's number one. And I think we saw a lot of candidates, both on the Republican side and the Democratic side, they just didn't know how to handle insult.
Uh-huh.
And it's understandable why, because that wasn't a feature of our prior political language.
It's not civil.
And so it's not part of your training. You know, you're not prepared for it. It's not part of your debate preparation. But I think that the second aspect that's related to language that the candidates of the future are going to have to come to the table with is speed. They're just going to have to be fast, and they're going to have to be able to offer what I think of as quick, quotable, tweetable, soundbite responses. And the truth is, we've had those kinds of candidates, those kinds of politicians in the Democratic Party before. We've had those people, but we may not know who they are now. And somebody I'm thinking of, I was listening to, I believe her first name is Cecile Richards. She was the longtime leader of Planned Parenthood.
Yes.
And she was asked if she had any regrets. And I thought what she said was so moving and so interesting. She said that her only regret is that her mother, you know, Governor Ann Richards, didn't live long enough to be on Twitter. And I laughed when I said that. I thought,
yeah, she was brilliant. She had some great lines.
Remember how she said, you know, he was born with a silver foot in his mouth?
Yes.
And I thought, you know,
that's Twitter material.
Exactly, exactly. So we've had those kinds of politicians, but we need them now. We need somebody like that. We need somebody who's going to be able to keep going in the face of insults, but also someone fast.
Yes.
Someone fast. And I would say we need to channel the spirit of Ann Richards and find someone smart, and people who are smart, people who are fast, and people who are not afraid. And I believe that we can.
Love to talk to you again. Avia Kushner, who writes often in The Forward, which you can get online, and talking about language. Thanks so much for being with us. Very, very interesting.
Thank you so much. It was a delight to be with you.
Likewise. We'll do it again. Thanks.
Thank you.